In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
There has been a lot going on this week. It has now been confirmed that Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, took millions of dollars from the Russians. It's been confirmed that the Democrats hired an actual Russian spy to help frame Trump as colluding with Russia. It's been confirmed that the FBI knew that the basis of the disinformation was a Russian spy, but used the information anyway and lied to the court to get a warrant to spy on then-candidate and then later President Trump. It's been confirmed that Robert Mueller, who was hired to look for Russian interference in our election, knew that it was a Russian spy who launched all of this, because Mueller had investigated the Russian spy for 2 years when he was head of the FBI in 2009 to 2011. The whole of the mainstream media has been lying to you about Trump and Russian interference for the last 4 years. Has there been a single apology from anyone in the media on behalf of the company? We really got the Russian collusion thing wrong. We were misled by our sources, who clearly had a political anti-Trump and really, when it comes to it, anti-American motives. And because of our own bias, we too eagerly believed it. This should have never have happened, and we're sorry, and we will do all that we can to expose the people who misled us. Have you heard anything like that? Because of those lies, probably 90% or more of Democrats to this day still think Trump is some sort of Russian agent. But here's the thing. When someone who has been exposed as a liar, it always begs two questions. What else have they been lying about? And what else will they lie about in the future? Liars will always keep lying until they finally come clean and try to do better. We haven't seen that yet. But I want you to think of that when it comes to the Democrats, the media, and what they've been telling you about climate change and what happened to our forests and all those fires. That the earth is getting hotter and drier. That Oregon has been experiencing 30 years of drought. Because when you know you're dealing with a liar and you can't trust their words, the next thing to do is to watch what they do. Watch what they do. Not what they say, it's what they do. Or, in the case of true climate change believers, what they don't do. It's when actions are different than what they say they believe, that's when you know that you've caught them in a lie and they shouldn't be trusted. Joining us now is Dr. Bob Zybak. He holds a PhD in environmental sciences from OSU, and he is our longtime consultant for issues of forestry and timber and forest fires, especially since his dissertation was The Great Fires, Indian Burning and Catastrophic Forest Fire Patterns of the Oregon Coast Range from 1491 to 1951. Dr. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Mark. Good to be here.
Absolutely. We'd really like to analyze what happened now that these fires seem to be somewhat under control. We've heard the excuses from the governor and from other people in her administration. It's climate change. But before we look at that excuse, you had a great statistic that you have brought up on iSpy Radio before, that Oregon had only one major forest fire between 1952 and 1987. Why did we not have any major fires? How were the forests managed differently then compared to now?
Well, all of these fires are starting on federal lands, for the most part, wilderness areas and that. After World War II, we had a lot of young men that could operate heavy equipment. We had a lot of heavy equipment. We built roads, and we actively managed our federal lands to build housing for the nation, create local jobs, and to improve forest health. And then that began to change with the wilderness designations, Endangered Species Act, ability of citizens to sue the government and pay their lawyers and so on, leading to fuel buildups and then the catastrophic scale fires we've had from 1987 to the present, most of which occur on federal land that is no longer actively managed.
So one of the things that they blamed was the weather. We'll get more into that later. But was there anything particular about this year's forest fire season that has been vastly different than most years, like weather, drought, et cetera?
Well, the east one was unusually strong. But it happened on Labor Day after a three-day weekend. So lots of campfires, lots of people dispersed. We've had a pandemic. A lot of people have been cooped up all summer. So when the winds hit, there was a arrangement of fires across the landscape. And there had been a lot of arson going on in our cities. And Portland has been a pretty famous fort for several months now. So just kind of a what they call a perfect storm for one of our deadliest, worst fire seasons ever.
So getting back to that 1952 to 1987 time period when management was pretty different, if we'd had this year's weather conditions during a year back then, would we have lost 1 million acres?
We've had these weather conditions back then. We had them in the 70s two or three times. Your next guest, I think, can line those out, and we didn't have any major fires.
Okay, so they want to blame climate change. Governor Brown was out there on the Talking Head news shows talking about Oregon has had 30 years of drought, which is kind of weird because I remember distinctly recall several major flood events since 1995. Besides just pulling that out of her backside, where is she getting that Oregon has been experiencing 30 years of drought?
She just made it up. She's got advisors that are government bureaucrats and university professors that get paid handsomely by the government to come up with excuses for mismanagement of our federal forests. We have not had 30 years of drought. That's just any more than these fires are caused by climate change. That's just nuts.
Well, if you believe that climate change or global warming is real, that the Earth is hotter and drier because of mankind's carbon dioxide, then shouldn't she and the environmentalists be doing more to manage forests and prevent fires? Because otherwise, it seems to me you're building a carpet of matchsticks in the forest only to be shocked, I say, that they all go up in flames.
Well, the magic word there was belief. This is a more of a religious situation than a practical situation. And if we were dealing with common sense and reality, yes. The answer is obviously yes. If we're having some kind of climate crisis, we should be doing more in our forests to mitigate potential damage such as occurring. But there's a lot of hypocrisy going on in the political and academic spheres the last several decades.
Well, it just seems like if it is climate change, there should be a zero tolerance for any fire that pops up. You just immediately swoop in to extinguish it before it can really get started. So once this started, though, this year, given our current forest management practices, is there anything that they could have done differently to prevent these fires from, you know, burning 1 million acres?
They could have had several thousand people out there working for the last few decades, keeping our forests in an actively managed condition for the benefit of wildlife, for the benefit of local populations, for the benefit of rural economies, for aesthetics. There's lots that they should have been doing and could have been doing and know how to do that they have not been doing in the last 30 years. And in climate change, and as far as actively putting out the fires, that's another one of their myths that they're using, that suppressing fires is what's responsible for these fires, and that we need to let these things burn to be more natural and pristine or something.
Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. We'll have more with Dr. Bob Zybak talking about Oregon's forest fires and looking back and seeing what could have been done differently and what we can do to prevent these in the future. Stay with us. Oregon has made national news because of its inability to manage its own forests. Tens of thousands of people were evacuated. Over 4,000 homes have been destroyed. We're talking about that with Dr. Bob Zybak, whose academic focus was in catastrophic forest fires in Oregon. So, Dr. Bob, let's talk about fighting these fires. We know that two crews, one in Molalla and the other in Scotts Mills, they were ordered to pull back when the fires seemed to get out of control there in Clackamas County. But then private citizens, Molalla, stepped in. They jerry-rigged some equipment and fought the fires back. What were your thoughts about that ordered pullback and then the citizen fire brigade that stepped in? Was it a funding issue, the reason the professionals pulled back?
You know, I don't have any idea. I don't. The way they're fighting fires now, I can't understand a lot of it. You've got a lot of people, personnel that are paid to do certain things that are new as far as making decisions such as that. But as far as citizens fighting the fires, in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, if there was a wildfire, They could be commissioned into fighting the fire off the roads. The law was that they had to go into active duty because of the emergency. So that part was kind of heartwarming to see, and it's great that nobody got hurt.
Yeah, it's absolutely great that happened. But it's a little odd that the so-called professionals were ordered to pull back, because at the time they were saying it was just out of control and it was too dangerous, and yet the citizens went in and basically halted them. That seems kind of odd.
A lot of this seems odd. So I think that's just one more aspect.
Let's talk about the Beechey Creek fire. This was originally tagged a natural fire, but then investigators have since called it suspicious, and it is now being investigated. I don't know if they've gotten any further with that, but how do you know if a fire is lightning strike or man-caused?
Well, usually there's good evidence. Dry lightning across southwest Oregon will start 130 fires all at once, so you know they're lightning fires. Whereas on the Coast Range, lightning is extremely rare. Where we had a thunderstorm the other day with lightning, we also had heavy drenching rains at the same time. It's just very unusual to have a lightning storm in the Coast Range. And lightning storms are easy to track these days, and it's pretty easy to tell if lightning starts it. I'm not sure any of these fires, Labor Day fires, were started by a lightning. That's usually an excuse for they don't really know.
So you're thinking the Labor Day weekend, which is when the riots suddenly stopped up there in Portland, you're thinking these are probably more likely man-caused fires?
Almost all of them, I would think, whether on accident or on purpose. Power lines, of course, came down in the winds, but there were a lot of campfires from the Labor Day weekend, lots of unemployed people getting checks to stay unemployed. One of the fires I started along the Pacific Crest Trail, for example, and I'm sure that there were a lot of campfires or backyard fires that just simply got out of control because of the winds.
Mm. Well, does it look any differently, you know, when they go in and examine an area, does it look any different on the ground? So you have maybe a tree that exploded or something versus, I mean, is there physical evidence that they can say this is clearly nature, this is clearly mankind caused?
Well, I think people are part of nature, and we are the only animal that can use fire. So whether it's lightning or people or occasionally something like a volcanic eruption, is irrelevant. Without fuel, the fires won't burn. So the problem is the buildup of fuels. The source of ignition is almost incidental. Wherever people are, there's always fire. So if there's dry lightning, then there's going to be fire. If there's no fuels or limited fuels, good access to locations, those fires can be controlled.
Well, the Beechey Creek fire had started, I want to say, August 16th. It went basically unattended for 3 weeks. And Governor Brown took a long time, not just on that, but some of these other fires, took a long time, it seems, to call for federal help. Was there anything preventing the governor from calling in federal resources earlier than she eventually did?
She's basically incompetent when it comes to forest management, whether that's by design or limitation would be the argument. But the feds, I think it started in the Opal Creek Wilderness, and the feds should have put it out. I think they said there's safety hazards or steep ground or something, but there's really that should have never been allowed to fester for that long, 3 weeks before an east wind comes up, because east winds are very common in August and September, and that's when the big fires start. There was a weather report that these winds were going to hit, and it's just another example of gross mismanagement of our public forests that results in these types of events.
Well, in terms of the layers of government, I mean, how do state and federal forest management work together and interact? Are each solely responsible for just their lands? I mean, how does that work?
Well, they work together very poorly, obviously. In the past, the state has done very good at managing fires on state lands and private lands. We don't have very many fires on those. They're usually not of this magnitude. Federal policies in that, I'm not sure what the intergovernmental relationship is, but certainly there could be more political pressure put on the federal government to better manage these lands and these fires.
When you say political pressure, are you talking about from citizens, or can the governor of a state say, hey, I want you to manage these forests better, and if a fire starts on your land, we expect you to put it out quick?
I think both. I think our governor gets very little pushback from the Portland Democrats and the other people that have been managing our resources. And so citizens such as the Timber Unity Group, I think, are doing really good in getting the message out that we just can't continue to accept this level of incompetence and such feeble excuses of the climate is changing, or a fire used to be more natural, or this is natural and that is not. I think those are all moot points that are resulting in fatalities and damaged communities.
Yeah, well, especially stuff that doesn't need to happen. A listener, Jeff, had contacted me, and he had raised an interesting issue on the administrative and management side of things. If a fire starts on, say, federal lands, and they don't put it out in time before it spreads to state lands, can you give us some clarification on the interaction of those two agencies when there's a fire that starts on one and then spreads to the other?
It's a really a weird policy. If it starts on private land and goes to federal lands, the feds can sue, and they do that with power companies and railroads and so on. Mm. But if it starts on federal land and goes into private, tough luck. You can't sue the federal government. So that is a legal situation that has worked definitely against the people of California, Oregon, Washington, and most of the other states west of the Rockies in the past several decades.
Okay, let's go and take a break there. Coming up, whether it's the unemployment department or handling the COVID response, there isn't much that Governor Kate hasn't messed up. We'll talk about the people in charge next. And welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Bob Zybak, who holds a PhD in environmental science from OSU. His academic focus was in wildfires, and he has been a longtime proponent and advocate for true, realistic, and sensible forest management, something it seems to me to be completely lacking in Oregon's elected Democrats for the last 30-some years. So, Bob, according to the Oregonian, this current forestry board, which is supposed to have oversight over the forestry department and more, but the board is absolutely and completely chaotic and dysfunctional. Is this due to Governor Kate, or has it just been like this for years?
It's been like this for years. They used to have a makeup on the board in which they had professional foresters controlling it, and they might not have been the type of professional foresters we'd want in this day and age, industrial basis, but they knew what they were doing. In the last 20 years and more, they've changed the makeup of the board, and they get a lot of people without much experience in the woods. They're stakeholders now, not foresters, and we're seeing the results of that.
Yes, yeah. One of them is a guy from Trout Unlimited, and that has to be one of the biggest mistakes when it comes to how to actually run and manage a forest, for sure. So, for now, let's maybe forget about their poor timber management. It sounds like they're broke. They haven't been able to collect on some of the expenses they've had to put out in terms of, you know, trying to put out these fires. But in terms of them not having money, is that why we didn't have the crews or equipment that we needed when we needed it?
The rural counties have been really damaged economically by these federal forest management policies of the last 30-plus years. And that is yes. The short answer is yes. They've had to close libraries. This pandemic has caused rural counties with no evidence of disease or very little to shut down their businesses that they would typically collect taxes from, shutting down workers that would typically be paying taxes. So yes, it's economics, but it's more than just recent.
Hmm. So it sounds like if they had been logging timber like they were supposed to and being able to get, you know, obviously revenue off of that, would the counties then have been able to have their own firefighting equipment?
Well, your word is supposed to, and I would kind of agree with that. But absolutely, they've got county organizations that go back to the 1910 fires. So, and very good at what they're doing. But the lack of equipment, the lack of road access through road decommissioning, the lack of access to wilderness designations, and so on, have really tied their hands.
Mm. Well, as a result of these fires, we've got cities that have been absolutely devastated by these burns. Some completely leveled that it's going to take years to recover emotionally and some financially. What should we be doing over the next year or next few immediate years to start regrowing our forests in a healthy manner? I mean, where do we start? What are some of the first steps? And in other words, what are the best steps to rebuild a forest that's been destroyed by fire?
The very best and first step should be just like after the Columbus Day storm or the Tillamook fires. They should go in immediately and sell the timber to the east of these communities that's been recently burnt. There's really good market conditions. There's a real need for jobs that would produce tax revenues rather than using them. And we would have an immediate focus on the safety of the communities and to the betterment of rural unemployment. The second thing should be done is a different reforestation and maintenance program put into place once those lands have been salvaged.
When you say different,
in
what
my opinion,
way? Yeah,
meadows and prairies and berry patches, fire breaks along ridgeline areas that some of them thousands of years old have been planted to trees on purpose or seeded into trees through inattention. So prescribed fire has been eliminated through the Clean Air Act mostly. Logging's been eliminated through Endangered Species Act and riparian zones. There's just been a decision after another, political decisions made by elected lawyers to the betterment of their profession and the detriment of the rural communities. So reforestation needs to be looked at, and active management and maintenance of our forests once they're reforested is a real desirable goal. And it pays for itself.
Yes. Well, certainly have need for timber right now to rebuild all those houses that were destroyed. Speaking of which, we learned last week that Peter DeFazio literally sent in his vote, probably because he couldn't be bothered to leave his yacht at the D.C. Yacht Club, to vote no on a timber salvage bill recently. How much timber can be salvaged from a typical fire like this?
Virtually all of it. If it's a green timber, it gets killed, but it hasn't been severely charged because it's moist. Now, other dead trees and so on, smaller diameter trees, would be a different thing. But you could go in right now and begin cutting those merchantable trees plus the other fuels and salvaging immediately and have a good market for that those materials. The thing is, we're importing about 70% of our wood from Canada, which is exactly coals to Newcastle. It's just nuts.
Yeah, absolutely nuts. So what happens if you don't salvage it and you just leave that wood there and do nothing?
Then you have a hotter, greater fire like has occurred in the Kalmiopsis wilderness since 1987. The dead wood makes a better fuel than green trees, and it burns hotter and expands the perimeter of the fire. And we've known that and observed that and documented it since the six-year jinx, Tillamook fires of 1933, 39, 45, and 51.
Just more matchsticks on the carpet of the forest, it sounds like. So real quick, what's healthier, a forest that has been clear-cut and replanted or an area that has been burned and just left to sit there?
Oh, obviously, the first one, if we're talking about healthy as far as air pollution or wildfire or landslide, soil erosion, clear-cutting and replanting and maintaining that plantation is a proven safer, better, more aesthetically pleasing condition than burnt-out timber waiting to burn again.
You would think environmentalists would want to, actually care for the environment, but apparently not. Dr. Bob, unfortunately, we're up against the clock with you. I want to thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And welcome back. Joining us now is Chuck Weiss. He's a former meteorologist and current fearsome global warming critic. We'd like to have Chuck on because he's a clear, logical thinker, which is why he's such a good debunker of climate change marketing, or science, I guess you could call it. Chuck, it's always good to talk with you.
Yeah, always good to talk to you guys, too. Always listen to the show. It's great.
Well, thank you. So Bob Zybak is an expert on forest fires. You being a meteorologist, you're an expert on weather and the myth of climate change. We didn't ask Bob this, but I'd like your opinion, too. While the fires were still burning, Governor Brown was out on the mainstream media news shows blaming the fires on climate change rather than on what it was, which is bad forest management. In particular, she said that Oregon has had 30 years of drought So is there any truth to that drought issue? Because I recall several flood events since 1995.
Oh, it's absolutely false. She just pulled that out of thin air, Mark. There's no truth to there being any drought in this state at all that's gone on for 30 years. We have some dry years in the 30-year records, but we have a lot of wet ones. But when you add it all up, we are very close to the normal precipitation, both in terms of liquid precipitation at our observing stations and also the snowpack in the Cascades. So she's just making this up. It's a lie. And it's disgusting that this would come from a political leader like her, who's supposed to know what the truth is. She just doesn't seem to care anymore.
Well, I've seen some other reports, OPB among them, but we've got several others, and they're all saying the same thing, is that we've experienced 30 years of drought. How can they say that if there's no evidence for it?
They make it up, just like they make a lot of things up with the climate. We've seen so many cases where temperature records have been distorted. We know how they do it, because a lot of the observing stations that used to be available to us in the observing surface station record in the 1960s and 70s were basically abandoned for the automated stations that they've installed since then. But they never got rid of the station IDs, so you have all these stations and ID numbers to them that don't report anything, and they backfill those with false data. They call them estimates of what they think the temperature was, where they couldn't actually measure it. And then they mix it into these grids. They call it homogenization, and they come up with a fictitious number that's way too warm for what it actually should be. So they literally are pulling things out of a magic hat that have no physical relevance to them, no actual measurements, and then calling them measurements. And they can do this with practically any part of the climate record. And there have been studies done from people that prove this out. They've shown where they actually cooled the early part of the record and warmed the latter part of the century records of temperature to show a temperature trend that matches these false trends that are coming out from the climate models, you know, the predicted trends of temperature. So they try to match this up by falsifying data, and then they call it good and say that they have proof that the Earth is warming due to climate change, when the real temperature measurements show no such thing.
Hmm. Well, on a side note, did you know that they do the same thing with seasonal flu numbers? They don't actually go to death certificates and where it says this person died of the flu. They estimate it. And in a lot of cases, they just estimate what they think it ought to be.
Yeah, and they did this. They do this with COVID. If there's somebody that dies from a different cause that's not COVID itself, but they had COVID, they just call it COVID. They skew numbers that way too. It's really shocking. I used to think that there wouldn't be any, that this fraud in science didn't go much beyond climate, because I'd never heard of this before. But when the COVID disease struck, and we started hearing all these reports coming in about numbers and everything, and then I took a look at what you need to get a statistically valid positive or negative test with the testing methods they use, I realized they're subject to all kinds of errors. And they actually don't care. They just report numbers with these, often like they do with the climate issue. And so what you're getting is not necessarily a true representation of what's really out there.
Well, it would just seem like when you're talking about government programs, whether it's climate change or weather or COVID-19 or flu, whatever, you would think it would be against the law to publish false data. Why is it not?
You would think it would. I just don't know. I don't have an answer for that. In the science of meteorology, I wish we were more like engineering, but we're just not. You can do all kinds of things in meteorology that you couldn't do in other professions. In other words, in engineering, in order to be an engineer, you have to get a license, and to get a license, you have to have a specific number of credentials. In atmospheric science, the only yardstick we have to whether somebody's a meteorologist or not is to look at the standards that were employed or prescribed by the United States National Weather Service for employment opportunity as a meteorologist. And there they have a list of credentials that they want somebody to see before they would hire you. But outside of that, there's no requirement at all to whether you can call yourself a meteorologist. And we have all kinds of people that call themselves that today that have no credentials at all. And it's the same thing in the climate arena. You have a lot of people with PhDs and disciplines that are not even related to science, but they take a position with a doctorate degree on this issue and say they believe in climate change, and the media will tout their doctorate degree as a climate expert when they have no expertise whatsoever. Yeah. And you see this all the time. So it would help to have stricter standards, but the fact of the matter is, in this climate stuff, we just don't right now. So there's all kinds of opportunity to become fraudulent, and they certainly have to protect a lot of the climate industry that grew out of this perception that CO2 can change the climate.
Just imagine if you could just make up numbers in engineering. I'm sure that bridge could carry 14 tons, no problem.
Oh, yeah, they'd have some real trouble if they did that, I'll tell you, because the minute there was a catastrophe from a collapsed bridge, it's bad enough when correct engineering does it, because then they have to go back and do a post-morbid and find out, what happened and why did this thing collapse. Yeah. But if you had people doing this sort of designing with no credentials at all, it would be disastrous.
Yeah,
but,
absolutely.
The climate can have, and weather can have a similar effect if you have people advertising to be something that they're not. But we just never set the standards except for what's in the U.S. Weather Service. So there's a lot of phonies out there.
Yeah, something certainly needs to change there. Let's go and take a break. Coming back, we'll be talking more about that. The path, the better. Stay with us more with Chuck Wise. And welcome back. Chuck Wise is a meteorologist trained at Oregon State University. He's a retired airline pilot as well, and he's a fearsome critic of man-made global warming. And so, Chuck, I'd like to start talking with you about the path to getting better here, because we've got this notion that climate change is causing all of this, these forests to randomly combust, I guess, because they never bothered to clean anything up. And heaven forbid we actually look at forest management. It was kind of interesting recently. I shouldn't say interesting. It was disturbing that even in the wake of these massive fires, we're hearing that some polls here in Oregon are showing that people are blaming climate change instead of bad forest management for these fires, that people who want to do active forest management are fringe somehow and borderline conspiracy theorists. How do we turn that around and knock down the myth that climate change is the root of all evil and responsible for every ailment known to mankind?
That's a very good question, Mark, and I wish I had all the answers to it, but we have to remember that this whole narrative of climate change was started by the political class. If you go back and look at the history, Al Gore in the Clinton administration was the one who opened the floodgates to research money that went into the universities, because he wanted the academic types in universities to support his position he took on the environment, because he was just a believer for a personal reason, nothing scientific, but he was just convinced that these things change the climate like CO2, and he wrote a book back then called Earth in the Balance. Mm-hmm. And it started there, and then the money corrupted academia, because the tenets of getting the money from those like Al Gore, which hasn't changed since, was we want you people in academia to prosecute CO2. Which means if you're going to look at it scientifically from all angles and determine the truth or non-truth as best you can using science, you're not allowed to do that. You only get the money if you want to say something that supports the position that CO2 causes climate change. And then at the same time this all started, the idea came from academia that, well, gee, if we want to show this, we need to invent a climate model. And man, did they rub their hands together over that, because the money that it would cost to do this was enormous, but yet they knew there was an avenue to get it. And from there, it just snowballs downhill. The people who invented these models knew that they couldn't get the right answers if they're going to be honest. They knew what the mathematical constraints were. They didn't care. They were bound and determined to develop a model because they wanted the money. And from there, once you tell one lie, then you have to keep telling others to get this thing to stay under control like you want it. And it just snowballed into what it is now. There's an insane amount of money that goes into promoting this, a whole climate industry. And so when you want to turn things around and get it back to proper forest management, you've got to defeat these people now that are just all over the place. Their tentacles of the octopus have reached into every aspect of our lives, and it's very difficult to push back on this.
Yes.
But Bob Zybak, Dr. Zybak, is telling the truth. He's an Oregon Stater like I am. And we know that CO2 doesn't change the climate like these failed models predicted that it would. And that's all these people have to rely on to get their answers to things outside of skewing real climate data to conform to what they want it to, which means it's not real. It's fake. They made it up. And this is what you're pushing back on. It's very difficult. Try to get money to a researcher to write a paper in academia that shows this is wrong. It just doesn't happen. And in fact, the ones who did it on their own, we've seen their careers ruined over it. That's how powerful and corrupt the whole thing has become.
Well,
so I don't know.
I don't know
exactly what the answer to that is.
Yeah, I guess I look at these people that push this climate change stuff, and okay, if you believe that, then why not do something about it? Leaving the forest alone does nothing but create a carpet of matchsticks on the forest floor. But there was an interesting article from OPB that was out there pushing this climate change. That's why we have these forest fires and all the rest. But it was really interesting. They were interviewing a meteorologist based out of Medford, and he was he's been in like the weather service for something like 20 some years. And he got into work on Friday before Labor Day, and he's basically, oh my gosh, I can just see this coming. This is a horrible weather pattern that's coming. He called it the Chetco effect, I think it was called. And so he put up all these red flag warnings, and yet nobody did anything. On Labor Day,
yeah.
where was the governor? She was at a Labor Day picnic. So you send up all of these warnings, and yet nobody does anything, and then they turn around and blame climate change.
But if you believe that,
you should be doing something.
Yeah, climate change is just a deflection to the incompetence of this governor and all the bad decisions that she's made, along with all the people that she's hired beneath her. They certainly should have done something to start jumping on these fires long before they blew out of control, because she knew the meteorologists in the Weather Service and in the forest management people, they were all warned these east winds were coming, and they chose to do nothing about it.
And that's the thing. You look at their inaction, and it's almost like they wanted this to happen.
Yes, you know, you could almost, you know, what else could you conclude when they do this? But see, wildfires, see, when you take a look at the climate change narrative, increased wildfires were part of the narrative. So politically, they could make that happen by mismanaging the forest and just waiting for an opportunity like these east wind events to come up, because they've always tried to tell us that as the climate changes, weather events get more severe, when in reality, the exact opposite of that is the truth, not what they're telling us. You don't get more severe weather if the climate is changing owing to atmospheric CO2. You get less severe weather because all the jet stream patterns migrate to higher latitude, and they are the ultimate factors involved in producing major weather events. And so we know this from atmospheric science. There's no question about it. But yet we get lied to that the events of severe weather get increased by climate change. It's all false. But the fire narrative is something they have more control over, because they can manage the forests, and they just wait for an opportunity for a dry east wind like this to kick in, and voila, you know, they get the fire that they want, and then they turn around and say, this is proof, we've warned you, well, these fires are the result of climate change.
Yep,
it's the perfect political narrative, and they created it. It had nothing to do with nature, nothing to do with atmospheric CO2.
Yep, our models show that there's going to be more forest fires, and so we're going to do nothing and hope that we get the fire that we predicted. It's really shameful that we have lost 1 million acres just so that they can have a political point. Let's go ahead and take a break. Coming back, we're going to be talking about some hydroxychloroquine and some other lawsuits that may be coming here in the state of Oregon. Stay with us. And welcome back. Wrapping things up with Chuck Weiss. He's a fierce global warming debunker. He's also a former meteorologist, and unlike many of his critics among the global warming crowd, has a degree in actual science, not marketing. Chuck, though, we're going to shift away from climate change. And in this segment, I'd like to talk about holding people responsible. I mean, we've got these fire issues. Clearly, people need to be held responsible for their bad decisions. But we've got other big issues right now. The riots up in Portland, the COVID lockdowns, endless emergency orders. We know that you've been very passionate in the past about this particular numbskull governor that we've got, Governor Kate. But it's more than just her alone. She has surrounded herself with incompetence in all of her agencies. The unemployment agency just jumps to mind. And she has willing co-conspirators in the Democrat Party and legislature. Do you get the sense that any elected Democrats are actually listening to their constituents on these issues?
I get none, because I got involved in asking the question from the state of Oregon myself when we started learning about the therapeutics available to treat COVID-19, namely hydroxychloroquine. I thought, good, at least we have a therapeutic we might be able to use to basically neuter the lethality of this virus. And I was shocked when I discovered on my own that they blocked the use of this drug in the state of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And I started jumping all over that. I wrote to the pharmaceutical board and asked them why. They couldn't provide an answer, except they were saying that they use these flawed studies to try to say that the drug doesn't have any effect to do what some of the people said that it could. And then they actually even tried to say it could be dangerous to use, which was, this is completely false.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I wrote back to them and I just said, well, in my opinion, you're leaving yourselves an avenue of legal liability here, because whether you think there is or not, other doctors on the front line believe in this drug and they're prescribing it for their patients, and for you just to block it with no other reasons other than these doesn't seem reasonable, and I think you're making yourself liable to take that position. Well, in a matter of a few weeks after that, they undid the blocking. But then I started, so I was happy about that. But then I started hearing reports that doctors who prescribe this for their patients are being harassed by medical boards.
Mm-hmm.
Now.
Mm-hmm.
There can also be claims that the pharmacy, local pharmacy, is that, well, yeah, you have a valid prescription to get the drug to treat your COVID symptoms, but we don't have it available. They can just claim a shortage. That takes the liability away from them by doing stuff like this. And so I don't think the dirty tricks are over with it yet. And this, again, is just, I've never seen anything in my life where even in this profession, the government got involved and telling doctors what they can and cannot do. I mean, this is outrageous. A doctor who's got a license to practice, who's a bona fide, board-certified medical doctor, should be able to prescribe for his or her patient whatever he deems necessary to treat a condition. And, of course, you use the advice from drug companies on what's best to do that with. But hydroxy is a proven safe drug. It didn't have these effects that these people claim that it did.
No.
There's all kinds of bad politics involved. And so I'm sitting back going, my God, what's happening to the country and our world here to have these sorts of interferences going on? It's just another secondary nightmare that was born out of climate change. I was shocked.
Well, yeah, same types of models, for sure. As Peter Navarro tweeted out recently, there's more blood on the hands of CNN and MSNBC. The Economic Standard concludes hydroxychloroquine is a safe, versatile medicine that has treated hundreds of millions over seven decades. HCQ should be widely recommended, prescribed, or promoted to treat the China virus. And there's a really interesting study that we'll put up on iSpyRadio.com that people can download. And, of course, one of the things against HCQ as far as COVID, they were saying, well, you have to have all of these random clinical trials. We just won't accept anything without these random clinical trials. Well, in that study, they list about two dozen major drugs that never went through a random clinical trial. The tetanus vaccine, insulin, hydrocortisone. I had no idea that so many drugs in use today never went through these clinical trials. But the left is saying, oh, my gosh, we have to have those. Anyway, one of the things that was really interesting in that study is that, just jumping ahead here, it says, more importantly, it reduces mortality by a factor of 3 in patients infected with COVID-19. And also this, no credible study found worse outcomes with HCQ use. No mortality or other serious safety issue was found in these studies. So how many thousands of people have died as a result of Democrat governors blocking people from using HCQ? I could see where this would be a massive lawsuit that could easily stretch into billions of dollars.
Well, I think you could definitely make a case for it, because I don't think they have any reason that they could give you why they did that's medically or scientifically sound. And they're going against the advice and the what these frontline physicians want to use for their patients to treat COVID-19. It's a therapeutic that should be widely and easily available. And when they speak about clinical trials, hydroxychloroquine had these trials to treat other diseases. Like, they use it for lupus and forms of arthritis. There are things that it was always used for They used it for malaria. There was a number of things that had successful treatments for by its use that were in clinical trials a long, long time ago, because the drug has been around since 1955. And so we know just from those alone that it's safe.
Yeah.
So the only argument you could come up with that I could see that's against it is to say, well, we don't know if it works. Well, that's not for them to decide. Of course they don't. Maybe it won't work in some patients, but the evidence seemed to show that it does. Yeah. And if it's safe, what have you got to lose?
Well, and that's exactly right. What have you got to lose? You're dealing with an unknown virus. It should have been an all of the above approach on this. But they also blocked the use of it before there were any studies at all that showed a negative impact. I mean, it's one thing if you've got a study that says, oh my gosh, this could kill people. They didn't even wait for a study to show if there's any negative effects. So
yes, they did. That's exactly what they did. And so the only conclusion you could draw from that is their decisions were entirely political, and they want to make Donald Trump look bad because he talked about it at the beginning of therapeutics for COVID-19.
Yes. Yep.
And the minute he did, it's like orange man bad. They got to jump all over that and say, nope, if you want it, we don't. And these bureaucrats started blocking the use of it. But I think there was even more to it than that. These other drugs like remdesivir came out, and I think the big pharma industry promotes these drugs, and remdesivir is $3,000 a dose. You can't even get it till you're so sick you're in the hospital.
Yeah, and HCQ is like $10. So, you know,
exactly.
it just seems if you want responsible, sensible solutions, whether it's forests or riots or responses to pandemics, you're just never going to get to where you want to go with Democrats in charge. Chuck, unfortunately, we're up against the clock. I want to thank you so much for your time today.
You're very welcome, Mark. Glad to be with you. I'll look forward to talking to you again in the future.
That is all of our time for today. We hope that you're at least a little wiser for having been here. Whether it's lies about hydroxychloroquine, lies about climate change, or lies about not managing forests, don't trust words, trust actions. Think about it. How did climate change stop you from managing forests? It didn't. That's how we know that you're lying. It's actions, not words. Or as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Remember that at the voting booth this year. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.